Hugh Mackay, welcome to the Last Post podcast interview. How are you?
I'm extremely well, all things considered. Pandemic, age, etc. But really, I'm one of the lucky ones, I suppose. I don't rely on a job. I don't have a mortgage to pay anymore, and I'm reasonably healthy. So, in some ways, this has been a bit of a godsend, really, a time for a lot of reading and reflection and some writing. But of course, it's been a terrible time for a lot of other people. On the other hand, I think, in retrospect, apart from the people who've been very ill as a result of the pandemic, I do think we're going to look back on this as one of those formative periods that occasionally come along, whether it's a war or a depression or a pandemic, almost always. The generations who are formed by these big events look back and say, well, it was terrible, but it was the making of us. It clarified our values, reordered our priorities. We rediscovered the importance of the neighbourhood, looking out for each other, all that sort of stuff. So I think this will be another example of that, Greg.
Yeah, very well said, Hugh. And yeah, we saw that with our parents, or depending on age, of course, from the Second World War, after the Second World War, and certainly that was true too. But you've been spending your time brilliantly, I may say, having read one of your two books that have just been released. You've got two new books, The Inner Self and The Question of Love. So I think both books are connected, and one's fiction, one's non-fiction. But if you just tell, I know that The Inner Self, it's a beautiful, brilliantly written book too, I must say, Hugh, about people's attempts to find themselves, or their reluctance to, because of the difficulty involved. But how are the two books connected, first of all, to set listeners right?
Yes. Thank you, by the way, for those very kind remarks about The Inner Self, Greg. I appreciate that. The novel, The Question of Love, I actually started writing about 4 years ago. It's a fairly unusual structure, because I've taken the musical, well, jazz lovers will understand about improvisation, where a jazz musician states a theme and then goes through a whole lot of improvisations and then ends up restating the theme at the end. And classical composers do the same thing. And the so-called theme and variations, and that's the structure I used for this book. So it's quite short, and it's a very unusual structure. But it took a long time to get it right. When I finally did get it right, I had begun work on The Inner Self, and my publisher, I think very astutely, said, well, actually, The Question of Love is a bit like a case study of some of the themes in The Inner Self, so why don't we bring them out on the same day, which is what we did earlier this week. So the thematic link really is, The Question of Love is a very intimate portrait of a marriage, bringing out the ways in which the husband and wife hide things from each other, not in a deliberate or malicious way, but they just do, and often hide from the truth about themselves as well. And that is very much the core theme, Greg, in The Inner Self. I'm really saying, look, all of us have outer shell, a kind of personal identity, the way we appear to the world. And in fact, in the first half of life, that's what we're mostly concerned about, sort of establishing our identity, discovering ways in which we are different from everyone else. That's what identity is all about, identifying us and how you can tell the difference between you and me. But typically when we reach around about our middle years, in fact, it's often the trigger for the so-called midlife crisis, we begin to realize that actually there's more to us than that outer self, that outer shell that's visible to the world. That within us, there is another self, One of the psychiatrists I've quoted in the book refers to our authentic being, and eventually we come to realise that there is an authentic being inside. And so I think for many of us, as we move typically into the second half of life, sometimes it happens at a younger age, but typically as we move into the second half of life, we start thinking more about, well, who am I really? I'm not just a social researcher. I'm not just a brother or a father or a neighbour or a member of a choir or any of these other things that people can easily see about me. There's an inner Hugh. There's an inner Greg. And this book is really an attempt to go quite deeply into the question of that inner self, and then to examine why, we can examine this right now, examine why so many of us are reluctant to face that and actually try to hide from the truth about who we are.
I think Emma Thompson, you quote Emma Thompson talking about wondering what she would be without her roles and her history and who she really was.
Yes, that's right. And she had that reflection just before her 60th birthday, when she decided that actually it was time to take away all the masks and get behind all the roles and the responsibilities in her life and say, well, actually, who is the real Emma? Now, there's the interesting paradox, I suppose it is, which lies at the heart of all this, is when we go really deeply into ourselves, looking for the essence of who we are, we discover that it's like the opposite of the outer shell that we present to the world, which is all about difference. When we go really deeply into who we are, we discover our common humanity. We find that at our core, we are like everyone else. We are members of the same species. And because we humans belong to a social species, that means that in the very essence of our nature, we are people with the capacity for love, compassion, kindness, respectfulness towards others, because that's the only way this species has survived through history. It's the only way we can survive. As families, as friendship groups, as neighbourhoods, as workplaces, clubs, associated groups of all kinds are what sustain us. We're hopeless on our own. We need each other. And the only way to make those communities, those groups function, is for us to create, as far as we can, social harmony. And that means treating everyone kindly, respectfully, compassionately. I mean, compassion is a key word in the book.
It is love, isn't it?
The point about that is that it's rather demanding. We realise that we're on the earth to be loving creatures, but that's hard work. And sometimes we don't. Sometimes we hate. Sometimes we're not tolerant of other people. We resort to prejudice. Sometimes we're not kind. We're indifferent towards other people. Sometimes we're not respectful towards other people. In fact, we're contemptuous of other people. There are natural resistances to the demands of love and compassion. And so we create another way of thinking about that, Greg. If you think of it, this capacity for love or compassion, whatever word you prefer, at our center, you could almost think of it as being like the sun at the center of our personal solar system. All the planets are like all our individual qualities and characteristics, but at the heart of us is this bright light, which we'll call love. And like every bright light, it casts shadows. So there are plenty of places to hide if we're not in the mood or not yet at the stage of maturity where we can say, actually, we're all in this thing together, And by the way, a pandemic reminded us of that, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed it did, Hugh.
How interconnected we all are.
Incredible. I think you said that, of course, with Mahatma Gandhi's famous remark that the best way to find ourselves is to lose ourselves in the service of others. And you give brilliant examples of hiding places too, Hugh. And I identified with a few of those as being reminding me of people that I have known. And you're speaking about loss as, you know, happiness, the pursuit of happiness was a classic. I actually spread that on social media. I was that impressed with parts of that chapter. And yes, just go through that with us if you can, Hugh, because the pursuit of happiness, there is a cult, if you like, almost of LA-based orientation towards happiness. And yes. There's been books written about it, how that is the ultimate pursuit. But tell us why it's not.
Absolutely. It sounds so reasonable, doesn't it? It sounds as though, well, naturally what we all want is to be happy.
Mm.
But it's a terrible fallacy. And as you say, it's a sort of LA-based cult that's got our culture in its grip as well. And the problems, there are many problems with it. The first problem is that happiness is a fleeting emotion. It comes and goes. And we can't set our moral compass according to whether we're happy or not.
Mm.
In fact, we wouldn't even know what happiness was if we hadn't experienced sadness and loss and disappointment and pain.
Mm.
All of those things create the context in which we enjoy those lovely fleeting moments of happiness. But also we have to recognize that every point on the emotional spectrum has something to teach us about who we are, and most the best teachers in that emotional spectrum tend to be the ones that do cause us a bit of shock, a bit of pain, or a bit of anguish. Our folklore has always said we grow through pain, and I think that's true. Psychologists in the so-called positive psychology movement would say that life satisfaction doesn't come from pursuing happiness. Life satisfaction comes from pursuing meaningfulness.
Yes, yes.
And typically, we feel happy as a result of things we take, things we consume. Our meaningfulness, our sense of deep life satisfaction, comes from things we give. Now, we're talking in the context of the last post. We're talking, among others, to veterans and the families of veterans. Who better in any society to understand that the richest experiences, the most formative experiences, the most valuable experiences that give us our clearest sense of life's meaning often do involve pain and sacrifice, and has nothing to do with pursuing happiness. So that's a real red herring, but it's a great hiding place, because if you say, no, I'm all out for happiness, what
happy.
I want out of life is pleasure, well, you're missing out on what life is really about, and you'll be blinded to your responsibility to respond to the needs of other people.
No, very well said, and I can identify that personally, as I'm sure we all can, through loss, etc., etc. And I guess, too, you mentioned the veterans there, Hugh. Of course, the legacy would be to live meaningful lives. That would be the true legacy. But you had some brilliant examples of hiding places, including, I think, busyness is another one there. And tell us about busyness.
Yes, busyness is another contemporary favourite, isn't it? Actually, another little observation about the pandemic, Greg. I think it's been like a great pause. We've all had to suddenly slow down, whether we wanted to or not. And I've heard countless people saying, through the experience of the lockdown and beyond, this has been a very important corrective, a very important reminder that actually we didn't need to run so hard, that we didn't need to go to all those meetings, we didn't need to buy all that stuff, we didn't need to do all that travel. We were perhaps neglecting some work on our own inner life and some work on our most precious relationships by always being... I mean, busyness is like the great barrier to social connection. We're all too busy to spend time just being with each other.
Yes.
And certainly when you get on the busyness treadmill, you're not likely to be reflecting too much on the state of your inner life. I mean, the same could be said, another one that I think people don't often think about is nostalgia. We often hide from ourselves in the present.
Yes.
By sort of hankering after the way it used to be.
I know a few people like that, that's for sure.
Well, we'll deal with it to some extent as we get older, but I think that the point we often miss about nostalgia is that we're not really hankering after the way it was in the past. We're really hankering after the way we were.
No, that's right.
We're wishing we were back there. You know, people say they don't build cars the way they used to. Well, just as well, because they're much safer than they used to be.
That's right.
But what they're saying is, I liked myself back there when they had cars like this. And that's a sign that we're not doing enough work on who we are right now.
Very well said, because I guess back then, if you're hankering for being back then, when you arrived back then, you were probably hankering for a time before that.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's an infinite regression of nostalgia. I mean, you know, people in the 40s were hankering after how it was in the 20s, and people in the 20s were hankering after how it was at the turn of the century. You know, it just goes on forever.
Yeah, that's right.
Because
that's right.
Partly it's to do with the fact that we know we can handle the past because we have handled it.
Mm.
We're not so sure about the present or the future.
And we all know people who that you get on the phone to speak with them, and you might get their PA or someone saying, "Oh, you know, he or she's very busy." And of course you think, well, we're all busy, if you want to use that word, but it depends on what you want to be busy at, you.
Yes, yeah, exactly. What will I choose to devote my time to? In fact, I quote a particular case in one of the little stories I tell in the new book of a person who was confronted with precisely that question. A bloke approaching the end of his working life, and someone was running a little seminar in his workplace or something and said, "Look, the only way to know what you really value in life is to see what you spend most of your time doing."
Yeah.
And this bloke thought, "Well, I know I have to spend about 8 or 9 hours a day at work, but what do I do with the rest of my time?" And that was a very searching question for him, because he realized that the people he would say were the most important people in his life, his wife, his grown-up kids, his immediate circle of friends, and even the neighbours in his own street, he realised he was not spending much time with any of those people.
No, that's right. And I think probably with I guess a lot of people might be scared at what they might find, Hugh.
Yes.
As you mentioned in the book.
I think that is a fear, Greg. And, of course, when we go inside, for the reasons I've been talking about, really, this bright light, this capacity we have for being loving, positive, compassionate, kind, respectful people, it does cast shadows, and there's dark stuff in all of us. I mean, because we've all looked for ways to avoid doing the right thing, or avoid, you know, being kind to someone who we actually can't stand, or whose politics we can't bear. But being human, our responsibility is to extend kindness even to those people. But when we don't, we're actually not being true to our nature.
Yeah,
we're not being fully authentic humans.
Yep.
And there is that dark stuff in it. We'd all have to face that we've fallen short in all kinds of ways, and not being the best that we could be. So the question is, do we keep hiding and live a kind of half life, not fully authentic because we're not facing up to this truth about ourselves, or do we square our shoulders and say, okay, let's take a look at this. Who is the real me, and what is the gap between this outer shell that I present to the world and the inner self that I know I really am?
That's right. And when we were born too, Hugh, we didn't have a name. We remain that person that was born before we had a name. So you're Hugh and I'm Greg, and that's how we're identified. But we are something a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very nice way of putting it, actually. I mean, when we're born, we're fully human. Yeah. And this capacity is within us.
Yes.
And it's often, as we said a moment ago, it's often when you've been through that early journey of trying to establish your place in the world and sort of find your toehold on the planet and get your identity established, it's only when that work is done that you start saying, well, actually, there's a lot more to me than all that stuff.
That's right. And I guess you spoke about the fear that some people may have of going too far in themselves, and they adapt all these excuses that you've listed brilliantly in the book. It's a strange complexity of issues, Hugh, because, of course, we do know, as you state in the book, that love, for instance, will bring out the best in us, but we don't always want the best brought out in us. We fight against that.
Yes, that's right. I think we can all recognise that we have quite... I mean, it's the same with ethical dilemmas we face, Greg. Sometimes we say, look, I know what's the right thing to do here, but actually I'm not going to do that because I'm driven by some other desire that's more powerful. Yeah, I'm driven by a particular ambition or a particular material desire or whatever it might be. So I'll actually consciously, deliberately do something that I know is not the best thing for me to do, and that's the same in the capacity for love, the capacity for compassion, which drives our goodness. And yet there are times when we say, actually, that's too much work. You know, I don't want to be that good. I mean, in a really simple example, there are cases you see someone in the street, for example, someone falls over, or, you know, their shopping bag bursts and stuff goes everywhere. And you know in that moment, the only reasonable thing for a human being to do is to stop and help that person out of the jam.
Yes.
But you might say, oh, gosh, it's raining, or I'm in a hurry, I'm running late for a meeting or something, and you just almost pretend you haven't seen that. Now, that's a subhuman response. That's denying our humanity. The natural, pure human thing to do is to respond to a need wherever we find it, to behave altruistically. You know, if you see someone in difficulty in the surf and you're able to either call for help or to rush in and give help, you just do it. You don't do it because you're hoping for a round of applause or a gold medal or for someone to say what a hero you are. You do it because that's what humans do. And when we don't do it, that's when we're diminishing our own humanity.
Yes, and that's right. And I guess also, Hugh, is that it makes us better people. We feel better about it. I guess that there's would you call it a happiness from giving?
I'd avoid the word happiness for the reason we discussed earlier, Greg, but I would say there is a deep sense of satisfaction and enrichment of the meaning of my life. I now see myself doing the right thing for humans, that is, responding to someone else's need. And there is a bit of a warm glow attached to that, but more particularly, I think we just enjoy the feeling that that's an authentic human response. I've been true to my species. I haven't been a hero. I've done the right thing. That's not heroic, but it would certainly be unheroic not to do the right thing in a situation like that.
Yes, that's true too, Hugh. And of course, I think, pull me up if I'm wrong here, but I think this is reflected in the fact that when you give, you feel good about it, but it just takes it up to another level when the person that you give to enjoys and appreciates and finds happiness or whatever in what you give. And that goes for, I guess, material presence and also honesty, etc.
Yes, absolutely. And just back to the veteran point of view on this, Greg. I mean, when we think of Anzac Day, now Anzac Day is a very controversial day in Australia's history, but it's never been a more popular focus for national celebration than it is now. And particularly with the terrific surge of young people who want to celebrate and mark Anzac Day. Mm. This, I think, relates precisely to the point you've just made. I think from the point of view of people who are not veterans, from the point of view of members of the community, people have this enormous sense of gratitude towards people who were prepared to make such an extraordinary sacrifice on their behalf. There's a feeling that that sense of gratitude is therapeutic for people. They feel a wonderful surge knowing that someone made a sacrifice on their behalf. And conversely, of course, veterans who don't want to swagger around 365 days of the year with medals jangling on their chest or being puffed up and saying, hey, I'm a vet. Quite the reverse. Most of them are extremely humble and modest about all that. But they know the therapeutic effect that their sacrifices, their service has had on this community, and that is therapeutic for them. Just to know what you've done for others, in this case for an entire nation or an entire way of life, is of course an enormously therapeutic experience, because there's a rather extreme, rather dramatic example of people who are absolutely true to the deepest sense of their humanity.
That's right, Hugh. I think I learnt that at an early age without wanting to sound like a prat, but I think because my twin brother and I became junior leaders at Red Cross, and we had to look after kids on the camps and stuff, and it was wonderful. And, you know, just things like that, I guess. Mum was a nurse, and you're aware of the beauty of giving and not expecting to be patted on the back every 5 seconds.
That's right. And just to repeat, you mentioned that Gandhi quote early in the conversation, Greg, just to repeat it. I think it captures this nicely, where Gandhi said, the best way to find yourself, important set of words, find yourself, is to lose yourself in the service of others. I think that's precisely the experience that you've described. It's the experience of many vets, and it's the experience of people who are just friendly neighbours in their street, who know that someone at the end of their street is old and a bit frail and in danger of being socially isolated and left out, worth spending a few minutes, a couple of times a week, to just hang over the fence and pass the time of day and let them know that they are valued. That's serving that person. That's losing ourselves in the service of a person who needs us.
What makes the difference between a person that's willing to look into the inner self and a person that keeps not doing that for various reasons that you've outlined in your book, The Inner Self? Hugh, why would one do that and why would one not?
Yeah, it's easier, of course, not to go inside, but I think for most of us there are trigger points in life where we can hardly avoid going on this inward journey. And those trigger points are things like, well, for example, a 40th birthday or a 50th or a 60th birthday if we've left it that late. Sometimes it's the birth of a child that changes your whole perspective on life and raises deep questions about who you are and what influence you're going to have on this young life that you brought into the world. It might be a bereavement. It might be a retrenchment. It might be a relationship breakdown. It might be a pandemic, as we said earlier. I think that's been a trigger for a lot of people. It often does require some trigger that causes us to say, now, what's underneath all this? One of my heroes in the field of psychology, an American psychotherapist called Carl Rogers.
Yes.
Said towards the end of his life as a therapist, he said that the most common question that his clients asked him was not necessarily in these words, but the way he expressed it was, how can I get in touch with this real self underlying all my surface behavior? How can I become myself?
Right.
Now, some people go to a psychotherapist to try and find the answer to that question. Most of us are able to find it through just a bit of self-reflection, a bit of time spent considering what the gap is between the way I appear and the way I really am, or the gap between this deep knowledge of what is required of me because I'm human,
mm-hmm.
and the ways in which I'm perhaps falling short or hiding from that responsibility.
Yes, yes, that's right. And it makes, I guess there's a connection to that. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are certain people you come across that listening to them makes you tired because they talk so quickly and they fill up every gap of moment with some superfluous topic that is of no interest to you, and it's probably of no interest to them. Are they scared in a conversation of things losing? They would be a prime candidate, I imagine, if they're scared of losing a conversation or losing control of that.
That's a really interesting observation, Greg, because people who are great talkers and who, as you say, just cannot bear the silence and will just talk over you like a steamroller, they will often think of themselves as good communicators because they're fluent and unstoppable talkers. But of course, that's the opposite of good communication. The key to good communication is listening,
mm-hmm.
which is another aspect of hard work that we have to put in if we're going to be much use to each other. But I think you're right. I think often people who just keep talking, same as people who just keep partying, you know, have to be socializing all the time, anything
yes.
to avoid the silence,
yes.
are actually hiding.
Yes.
They're actually trying to postpone that encounter with the inner self, which eventually, for most of us, has to happen, and we hope it's going to happen while we're still young enough and energetic enough to be able to do something about it.
Quite brilliant, Hugh. And I guess it goes to the comment, I found some connection with Donald Winnicott, was it, who said that it's a joy to be hidden but disaster not to be found.
Yes.
And I guess the complexity there too is that I suppose people that would like to hide also rush into superficial relationships, knowing that probably it won't last forever because there'll come a point when you won't want to reveal any more about yourself and then you'll just skip out. But I guess during that time of superficiality, of presenting an attractive package to the person that you want to be with, you're hiding from yourself again on another level because you're just presenting yourself as something that you're not really going into who you are. So I
think that's true. In fact, one of the hiding places that I mentioned in the book was addiction.
Yes.
And many people are addicted to falling in love, for example.
Yes.
Addicted to new relationships, new conquests. In fact, I quoted in heavy disguise, of course, but a chap that I used to work with who was clearly addicted to sex.
That's right. Yes, indeed. Yes, that was interesting.
And that was his way of avoiding self-knowledge. It was his way of hiding from the truth about who he really was, because he was just always on the lookout for the next woman. And it's the same people who are always on the lookout for the next whatever it might be, car, handbag, etc. We can very easily distract ourselves in those ways. But another hiding place, which is captured by what you were saying a moment ago, I think, Greg, is arrogance. You know, that there are people who are so convinced of the rightness of their position and the value of their opinions that they're going to lay all this on everyone else nonstop and not really listen to any challenge from anyone else or harbour any alternative opinions.
Jeez, Hugh, I tell you what. I tell you what, one politician came to mind. One politician came to mind. It was as though you were describing him.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, there have been a few of them through history, but we're dealing with a terrible one right now.
Yes, indeed. And that's right. It's the narcissism combined with the fact that obviously a person who's too scared to look into themselves. But, Hugh, we could go on forever. It's been a brilliant discussion. I really thank you for your time. It's a brilliant book, and I'd recommend to anyone to buy The Inner Self and have a read and just be entranced and encouraged to do this look into the inner self that Hugh talks about. Thank you so much, Hugh.
Thank you very much, Greg. Great pleasure.
Thank you.